Well, you don't know.
Mine's
just
falling. Mine's just falling.
We're doing a sound check.
It's falling. I know it's.
This is the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services. The date is February 12, 2007. The time, 3 p.m. Hearing Room C. Committee Chair is Senator Bill Morissette.
Committee, the first item on the agenda is to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 184. I'm waiting for you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 184.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the Senate vote on Senate Bill 184. Discussion, objections. Seeing none.
Roll call.
Okay, we'll do the roll call.
It's all right there.
Oh, okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Excuse.
Senator
Montefiore.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Morissette.
Aye. Okay, objection. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 184 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Okay. Okay, I'd like to discuss that for just a moment. Rather than rescind, let's not rescind the Ways and Means referral. We've agreed there.
This is the motion.
Oh, okay.
This is the motion, okay. So we have to do that.
Okay, it's been moved. Suggestion, discussion, objection. Seeing none, so moved. Okay. Yeah. Okay, work session on Senate Bill 184. Okay, is there a motion to pass Senate Bill 184?
What do you want to do? Do you still want to rescind?
No, we don't want to rescind.
Okay, so you want it to go away.
Okay, the discussion before the meeting with the proposals of the amendment that we were not going to rescind the rules. We will send it to Ways and Means. They can deal with the amendment in the Ways and Means Committee. The bill will be referred to Ways and Means. I don't think we should ask the President to rescind the Ways and Means referral.
Okay, then.
So let's just move the bill.
Okay. This time, Senate Bill 184, before we do pass a recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator Cruz moved Senate Bill 184 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Yeah, I took a look at the amendments, and I truly do believe that the amendments could be better addressed in Ways and Means. They can look into the ramifications on the cities, and who knows what kind of shenanigans they can pull to make sure that maybe local governments are held less harmless than they are in this particular bill, the way it's written.
Okay. Well, and I too feel that, you know, the cities have a point worth considering in terms of the revenue that they would not be getting, although it's new revenue. I think they can argue their point in Ways and Means Committee rather than here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. While we're opining, with full understanding, Mr. Chair, of the potential impact of cities, it's a small impact, but my sense is because this money is rolling back to counties for alcohol and drug treatment, that in the long run, cities are better off because the drain on their services will be less, and long term, And my preference on the record is that when Ways and Means considers it, they consider the real long-term aspects of where the money's going, not just short-term.
Mr. Chair, in Ways and Means, they're not going to consider policy.
No.
But I do think that in this level of discussion, we need to point out that it is the shared revenues that is a philosophical thing. It is an agreement with the cities that they have. And if you remember, some of the cigarette tax money was taken away from them. So I think to see cigarette tax money taken away and now the possibility of the OLCC money taken away, there becomes that anxiety about how they're going to continue to get the kinds of agreements intact that keep them sustainable. So I think that that is part of it. On the flip side of that, I'd like to support what Senator Peruzzi said, and that is that when you're looking at a program that is a very fine program and the way that the money is going to be spent, that's the other side of that argument. So while that particular thing may not take place in Ways and Means, I think that they will be able to work through the amendments in a better way, and I think it was a good move.
Okay. Thank you. And I just want to add that having been a former mayor and Senator Verger, a former mayor, we understand the often unfunded mandates that are passed on to cities, and cities do have a lot of business to attend to, and the funding aspects of it have been declining. And so I think this is something that we really do have to consider. It will go to Ways and Means. You will have an opportunity to put forth your amendment. On the other hand, I think this program that is proposed by 184 is of such overriding importance that I think it's important that we do stop the cost shift that cities will be involved in when, you know, I think the treatment is important to take the pressure off of law enforcement at the local level. So I definitely think there are some trade-offs, and there will be some benefits to cities by implementing the $17 million program. So I have mixed feelings, and I think that it will work its way out in Ways and Means. So with that, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Moniz Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator
Norris? Excused.
Senator Green?
Aye.
Graham
Morsett?
Aye.
Okay, Senate Bill 184 passes to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 37. And Representative Ron Maurer, would you please come up?
Good afternoon. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Representative Ron Maurer from Grants Pass, representing District 3 in most of Josephine County. I come to you today as the co-owner of a small primary care medical office. We are a Medicare-certified rural health clinic located in the town of Rogue River, which is 7 miles from downtown Grants Pass. My wife, Sheila, is a family nurse practitioner and the other owner of this clinic, and she is the sole provider to a panel of around 2,000 patients. And I'd be negligent if I did not give her most of the credit for the success of that business. The larger debate of health care reform must include all the residents of Oregon, whether those residents live in downtown Portland or 20 miles from downtown Bly, Oregon, with a population of 486. Rural Oregon does face a serious and unique challenge in the health care debate. Senate Bill 37 does acknowledge that the rural health safety net is in serious jeopardy. I'm here today to lend my support to the concepts of Senate Bill 37, but as always, I question the funding source for this crucial need. Anytime we become dependent on the monies produced from a destructive habit to pay for the larger yet unrelated societal benefit, I'll raise my hand to challenge that public policy. I believe that the structure of our health care delivery system is a function of the health care financing system. More simply, we treat what we pay for. If we are not willing to pay for emergency medical services in rural communities, then the day is not far off when those services will no longer be available. If we do not make primary care a living wage endeavor in rural communities, then these services will no longer be available. And if we do not provide support for rural hospitals, then these facilities will cease to exist. Senate bill, like many bills, may fall by the wayside because of that ever-present hurdle, money. But I implore this committee and the upper levels of health care reform to remember that rural Oregon needs a voice in this process and deserves your full consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott Ekblad, Tina Grainer, John Dellens. John, did you want to testify?
Yes, I do. I think my constituents are signed up.
Okay. Thanks. Sandra Wyman.
Good afternoon. Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, and I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 37. I believe that this bill addresses critical issues that characterize the rural health care safety net. I believe the passage of this bill would patch some of the gaping holes in that net. I'm going to talk today specifically about three principal duties that would fall to the Office of Rural Health should this bill pass. Our first duty would be to focus on pre-hospital care. And what this bill would do is to restore funding that we had between the years of 1999 to 2003 to provide grants to rural EMS agencies. Our office in particular made grants to rural EMS agencies for the purchase of equipment and improvement of healthcare systems. And I have excerpted the part of the statute that enabled us to do that. The funding stream would also allow for grants for education and training of EMS personnel in rural communities, but my colleague Sandy Ryman will talk to the specifics of that. The funding stream for the EMS enhancement account was diverted in the 2003 legislative session, and I wanted to let you know that during the four short years of its operation, our office received 354 applications from 134 rural communities for requests that totaled almost $6 million. Unfortunately, we were only able to grant about $1.2 million, about 20% of the total requests, if that gives you an idea of the overwhelming need. And then I have also listed some of the things that these grant funds paid for, and I have to mention the fact that, man, when a community receives a grant for an ambulance, they are pretty happy, even if it's just a part of an ambulance, because they are incredibly expensive. So we were able to do that for a handful of communities. Also, defibrillators, ventilators, a lot of communications system equipment, radios, pagers, jaws of life, and even things as simple as, I will never forget the application that asked for money for the pads that are used on a defibrillator, and just some basic first aid equipment, and just the fact that they needed grant money to pay for that just really grabbed me right in the heart. We believe that these funds actually saved lives in rural Oregon, and I wanted to mention a report that came out in 2005 by the Road Information Project out of Washington, D.C. They concluded that traffic fatalities are occurring on the nation's non-interstate rural roads at a rate approximately 2.5 times higher than on all other roads. In Oregon, according to that report, there were 2.74 fatalities per 100 million miles of travel on rural roads compared to 0.72 in urban on other routes. That's a difference of more than 380%. The second part of this bill deals with primary care. addressing Oregon's federally certified rural health clinics. As Representative Maher just mentioned, his wife is a practitioner in one of those clinics. Our office's field staff conducted an on-site survey of all the rural health clinics that were in existence at the time in 2004. And the results were really quite startling, and I'll just give you some highlights. The average clinic has over 3,000 visits per year, whereas the average operating margin is a minus 13.8%. 70% report a negative operating margin, 35% report a negative overall margin. So clearly, these are safety net clinics. We've targeted a subset of rural health clinics for the support that would be offered in this bill, and generally speaking, those are the clinics that live in or that exist in areas that are sparsely populated enough that they cannot survive financially based on patient revenue. This bill would provide a supplement to their operating expenses based on need and would also pay for support in the form of technical assistance provided by our office. And we would have a staff person dedicated to working with these clinics to keep them financially viable, to make sure that they are seeing the patients that they are intended to see. And I've listed some of the forms of technical assistance that our office can provide them. I'm proud to say that we have a staff that's very skilled in these areas. And then the third part of this bill that applies to the Office of Rural Health is the first step towards solving the problem of access to needed capital for rural facilities by providing seed money for rural health viability grants. Rural health viability grants were authorized by the 2001 state legislature, but as my testimony says, through a series of unfortunate events, never received the authorized appropriation. 25 of Oregon's rural hospitals have become critical access hospitals, and that's been very helpful to them because by being a critical access hospital, they get cost-based reimbursement for both Medicare and Medicaid services. I want to point out that for most of these hospitals, the great majority of these hospitals, that meant bringing them up from a surprisingly negative operating margin to just a bare negative operating margin. Some even are breaking even now or show a slight positive margin. So the point I want to get across is that even though they're getting cost-based reimbursement for their Medicare and Medicaid patients, they do not have the ability to build up capital to replace their structures, to make necessary refurbishing. And as most of the folks on the committee know, most of these hospitals were built with Hill-Burton funds through an act authorized in 1956. So these facilities are aging. And it's difficult for them to keep up with the changing needs of their patient population and really to serve their communities in the way they need to be served. Hospitals would not be the only rural facilities that would benefit from the Rural Health Viability Fund, the seed money in that fund, and I've given you a list of some of the other things that could happen, but essentially we're talking about the rural health care facilities that provide safety net health care to our rural populations. They need your help. This bill would do that. I'm very appreciative that Senator Morissette introduced this bill. And with that, if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Questions? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Morissette and committee. I'm Sandy Ryman with the Northeast Oregon AHEC in La Grande, and I want to talk with you about the EMT education funds. When you folks had enacted the legislation for SB 911 back in 99 and the funding was implemented in 2000, I'm here to describe to you the significant value which Oregon has received as a result of those funds. I also want to talk with you about how we need those funds again due to the high cost of education. And I want to help you to understand how this is really a partnership with rural Oregon, because if you folks provide the money, these people who are volunteering volunteers are still providing an incredible amount of their time to become EMTs and to continue to respond on an emergency basis to help their communities. So to go into detail on those 3 points, and the money which was received as a result of the Senate Bill 911, we educated 2,686 EMTs in the state, 890 new EMT basics, 192 new intermediates, 560 people which took continuing education that is required for them to keep their certification, and over 1,044 first responders. And so I felt like that was a significant contribution to the state of Oregon, and particularly to our rural areas, and that those funds provided a lot of value around the state. The current situation is that the price is quite high to be a volunteer EMT, and in addition to having to pay for classes, there are many hours of education and training, travel to the classes, the need for continuing education, and then the need for availability at all hours of the day and night. So there's costs that are both monetarily related costs, and there's costs of people's time and commitment in their lives. Let's take as an example Baker County. It costs a volunteer a minimum of $1,032 to obtain the education to become an EMT basic. And in 2004, Baker had one of the lowest median household incomes in Oregon, and it hasn't changed since 2004 data. But the average taxable income at that time was $23,700. Therefore, if you became an EMT basic volunteer in Baker County, it was taking 4% of your taxable income for the year if you were to pay for that yourself. And this is a lot of money to these people. If you can imagine raising a family on somewhere between $23,000 and $31,000, and then using $1,000 of that to take a class so that you could volunteer for all kinds of time, that's a significant investment. And I think that you can understand why we're seeing fewer and fewer volunteers for a situation like this because of these expenses. I provided you with the data on numerous other counties in rural Oregon also, including your county, Senator Cruz of Douglas County. Class and travel time I want to talk about also. To take a class, an EMT basic or an intermediate class, is 140 hours of in-class time. Then there's probably a fairly similar amount of time outside of class to read the materials and to practice the hands-on skills. And I assure you, if you're out there traveling roads in rural Oregon, you want to make sure they've practiced their hands-on skills pretty well. This is, in addition to this time commitment, there is the time commitment of doing the continuing education to stay in the class, to stay certified as an EMT, and all of this takes travel time. I went back through the applications for EMT education funds that we had awarded, and the smallest amount of travel time for people to get to a class was a half hour one way, and there were many people that were traveling 2 to 2.5 hours in order to take a class, and so even getting through the class is a significant time investment. I want to give you a specific example around that. 2 years ago, there was an EMT intermediate class with 6 participants. It took place at a ranch headquarters 30 to 45 minutes from Spray, Mitchell, and Fossil. It was kind of a central location, and the ranch donated the space for people to be able to do this education. And EMT intermediates are very important to rural areas. It was specifically created in Oregon to deal with the trauma and cardiac-related issues in rural communities. So there were 6 participants because there were not a lot of people in this area who were EMT basics and could move on to be intermediates. The instructor drove from Monument, which was 1 hour and 25 minutes one way. This class took place in the winter, and they met twice a week for 2 to 3 hours at each meeting for 20 weeks. And so this class was very significant. These people being able to become EMT intermediates was so important. The class would normally have never occurred because the community college, which covers this area, normally would require 14 students in the class. But with the EMT education funds, we were able to negotiate a no-loss, no-gain acceptable rate for this very small class in this very distant area. And this kind of event occurred throughout rural Oregon when those Senate Bill 911 monies had been available previously. So in summary, I'd like to say that the initial funds were a very important investment in rural Oregon, and that this funding is needed again to defer the monetary costs for the people that are willing to be the rural volunteers, and it's something you really need to think about as a partnership with our rural communities, because they then continue to invest their time in their training and in their continued education and in their service to their rural communities. I would also like to state that I feel that the legislation does need to be very clear that a portion of those funds need to be allocated specifically for education. I think all of us here, including Scott with the Office of Rural Health, knows that this is the intent at this time, but when I'm looking long term for the future, I would want to make sure that a portion of that was set aside specifically for education. So I thank you very much for your time and for listening to this, and I'd be very glad to entertain any questions.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Thank you for the information concerning the education that
yes.
people have to put out. The money for education that they have to pay, which is a significant amount.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Senator Morissette, I'm Tina Greiner. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association First Vice President to obviously testify in favor of this bill. I'm also a paramedic in a rural EMS agency. We don't provide ambulance transport for our patients, but we do provide what we call a quick response team. We obviously go to the patient who's either been in a car wreck or had a medical emergency and perform an initial assessment, secondary assessment, which would be, you know, find out what's wrong with them, and then, you know, if they needed an IV or if they needed to be spinal immobilized if they've been in a car wreck, and get them ready for an incoming ambulance who can be anywhere from 20 to 45 minutes away from us. I wanted to talk with you about the equipment grants part of this bill and how important it is to those of us in rural EMS, and how expensive even the most basic of equipment is. If we have one car wreck with one patient, which is pretty non-typical, usually there's two patients or more and there's two or more cars involved, just one car wreck with one patient costs a minimum of $250 to take care of that patient, including a backboard, which is the long, hard board that we put them on, straps to secure them to the board, head blocks to make sure that their head is immobilized, a C-collar to go around their neck to protect their neck from any further damage, a BP cuff to take their blood pressure, a stethoscope to listen to it, to listen to lung sounds, gloves, any splinting that they might need for extremity fractures, and miscellaneous bandaging supplies cost $250 for one patient. We don't have any way to recoup those. We don't bill for our services. We don't bill for transport. We have no means to bill for that. My budget where I'm at in SIO is $3,000 for EMS supplies for the whole year. We routinely go over that and steal money from other areas in our budgets. It's very difficult to even just have just the basic supplies to take care of a person, let alone more advanced supplies as far as a paramedic level goes. If someone's having a heart attack, a defibrillator costs anywhere from $4,000 to $15,000, depending on what it can do and how often the batteries need to be replaced and the supplies need to be replaced. It's very expensive. A monitor to tell us how much oxygen our patient is receiving, minimum $400. Jaws of life, if we've got someone who's been in a car wreck and needs to be extricated, $10,000 is the minimum price that I could find online last night. All of that, my fire department couldn't afford to do that without these grants that are available. And my fire department isn't nearly as small or as rural as some of those in Eastern Oregon. I'm not sure what else to say. I'm sorry. This money is just so very important to rural EMS. And without the money that this bill could provide for us, I'm just not sure how much longer some of the smaller agencies can continue to provide EMS. So.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, yes. Just a correction. She didn't mean to say steal. She meant to say...
Oh, sorry. Transfer funds.
Redirect funds.
Redirect funds.
Just for the record.
Senator Montessori.
Thank you.
I'm surprised that you're not able to bill insurance companies to transport.
I believe that some agencies do, and my agency has looked into it, but I'm not sure that our fire chief has proceeded with that. As far as car wrecks, it's my understanding that we can bill for out-of-district patrons who don't pay taxes for us. But where we're rural, most of the people traveling our roads...
How can we get that changed?
I
because
don't know.
To me, it only makes sense to bill. My father has made several trips to the hospital if it wasn't for the fire and the AMR, you know, their services. And one time insurance wouldn't cover it, and he had to pay, I think it was $650 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is something that we need to look into besides, you know, helping you this way, because I need to understand that why are your services are just as valuable as the services in the urban area, and I know you're volunteer, but you're still just as capable as those who are actually billing in the
mm-hmm.
urban area. Anyway, I was surprised. I didn't realize that you could not bill. You cannot bill for services.
Yeah, it's my understanding that we can't unless we transport or they're an out-of-district patient.
Well, if you can't transport.
Yeah.
You have to transport.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
we don't transport
right now. But if you transport, can you bill?
Yes, but we don't have an ambulance. I volunteer in Jefferson. I also volunteer in Sayo. We don't have an ambulance. We supply what we call, like I said, a quick response team. We're out there in anywhere. I've got 100 square miles that we cover anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes and a 20 to a 40-minute wait for an ambulance. We go through a lot.
I'm surprised that you're not able to bill insurance companies to transport.
I believe that some agencies do, and my agency has looked into it, but I'm not sure that our fire chief has proceeded with that. As far as car wrecks, it's my understanding that we can bill for out-of-district patrons who don't pay taxes for us. But where we're rural, most of the people traveling our roads...
How can we get that changed?
I don't
because
know.
To me, it only makes sense... to bill. My father has made several trips to the hospital if it wasn't for the fire and the AMR, you know, their services. And one time insurance wouldn't cover it, and he had to pay, I think it was $650 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is something that we need to look into besides, you know, helping you this way, because I need to understand that why are your services are just as valuable as the services in the urban area, and I know you're volunteer, but you're still just as capable as those who are actually billing in the
mm-hmm.
urban area. Anyway, I was surprised. I didn't realize that you cannot bill for services.
Yeah, it's my understanding that we can't unless we transport or they're an out-of-district patient.
Well, if you can't transport.
Yeah.
You have to transport.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
we
you're
don't
just
transport
talking
right
about...
Now.
But if you transport, can you bill?
Yes, but we don't have an ambulance. I volunteer in Jefferson. I also volunteer in Sayo. We don't have an ambulance. We supply what we call, like I said, a quick response team. We're out there in anywhere. I've got 100 square miles that we cover anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes and a 20 to a 40-minute wait for an ambulance. We go through a lot of supplies sometimes that, you know, we just have to make do with what we can. And it's getting tougher every year.
So you want to transport no matter what?
Well, I don't have an ambulance.
To get billed.
Right. And I don't have an ambulance where I'm at. And there's other regulations as far as ambulance service areas and providers and that kind of stuff. That's, we run 325 calls a year out there. It's not financially feasible for us to staff an ambulance, to purchase an ambulance at $150,000, $200,000, and even with volunteers to staff it. And if we've got a patient who is beyond our capabilities, you know, if I've got an EMT basic, two EMT basics responding, and I've got a patient who is having a heart attack, my EMT basics aren't going to be able to do a whole lot other than put the pedal to the metal and get the patient to a hospital. where, you know, we've got 40-minute transport times. We need an ambulance to come out. They can give them advanced drugs that we may not carry because we don't have the right people with us. It just depends on if you're having a heart attack, when you're having it, and who's going to be able to come out.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair, follow up on Senator Mona Sanderson's point, and especially in rural Oregon, even if you have ambulances, since how such a high percent of those populations are on public assistance, reimbursement rates to ambulances don't cover costs.
Yeah, in the urban area too.
Just wanted it on the record. We all know it, but I wanted it on the record since we were discussing that.
I don't know how extensive fire med organizations are. I know in Lane County we have fire med, which is a good supplement to the ambulance and does provide ambulance insurance. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a lot of people who have come from over 100 miles, and I'll get Representative Delamue in just a minute. There's Frankie Patrick, you have to leave.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you could come up, please. Yeah, and be relatively brief, and then Representative Dellums and his group will come up.
Yes, my name is Frankie Petrick. I am a EMT volunteer firefighter in Yahats, Oregon, which is in southern Lincoln County, and I've been doing that for 32 years. Back when I took my original class to be an EMT, I had to take another job to come up with the money to pay for the class because there was no funds available to do that. So when the previous rural health bill had some funds available for us to increase our personnel and help them out, it was a godsend. The money that's raised in our district, the Ambulance Association is affiliated with the fire district, but as Senator Cruz said, we have a high percentage of individuals who are low income, and the reimbursement from the state through the Oregon Health Plan is pretty slim. Doesn't quite cover the gas and the insurance. We do have a little bit of capability for billing through a fire district under the state fire marshal's office, but it doesn't allow for the reimbursement for any equipment that we use. It pays for an allocation for if a fire truck goes to a car accident. Funds are very, very scarce for us. So having funds to help educate and pay for equipment, a lot of people in our community who are involved with the fire service are making between $8 and $10 an hour, and having to reschedule work in order to make all of the classes. Their employers don't reimburse them for the time loss. So the funds that are available for education are a blessing for the small rural communities. We run about 214 ambulance calls a year. And for purposes of coming over, I tallied up, last year I volunteered in excess of 7,600 hours for my community. And I have two children, and they've grown up knowing that when the radio goes off, Mom leaves. And the community is very appreciative, but there's just not enough money out there to cover education and equipment. It's a real blessing for the small communities in Oregon. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you. I don't have a question, but she's from my district, and I just want to say welcome and happy to have you here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you being here. Representative Dellums, would your group come up, please? Sherry Holliday, Jennifer Mickle.
Mitschke.
All the way from Wasco County.
Yes.
And Montana, right?
And Montana. For the record, I'm Representative John Dollum, House District 59, Medells to Arlington, Black Butte to John Day and parts of Idaho. Thank you, Senator Morissette, and committee members. I have heard, just sitting here, testimony far in excess of anything that I can give. But I do want to introduce to you two constituents and give you the background. Trey Halliday is a county commissioner, Wasco County, and before that time was the mayor of Maupin. And one of the very first things that I did when I started to run was tell Sherry we would look for some money that had been allocated for ambulances. I spent my first session determining whether I was in the House or the Senate and couldn't find the money Sherry talked about. And when Senate Bill 37 was introduced, I went over to your office. Talked about a lot of things, but 37 didn't come as regularly as I would have liked it to have. But let me introduce to you two people from my district that I'm very proud to bring to you. First is Jennifer Mitschke. She's a retired elementary teacher. She's been in voluntary EMT service since 1977. She's a member of the state EMS committee. She's a training officer for Southern Wasco County Ambulance, and that's in my district, Maupin, Oregon. I've already told you a little bit about Sherry. I'm very proud to call Sherry a friend. As the mayor of Maupin, she was often referred to as a lady that could get things done. As a county commissioner, she's done an outstanding job for us. And with money for emergency vehicles on the table right now, you could bring a lot of peace to my life if you just give Sherry what she wants. And with that, I'll give you my two constituents, and they'll carry the ball far better than I could. And I believe I'm going to leave for a 3:45 appointment.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair. Before you go, Representative, if you had left out the part about bringing peace to your life, because I'd like to torment you myself, so well, I think we'll do this anyway. So,
but I had more time, and knowing that you were there, Senator, I'd have rephrased that. Thank you very much for the kindness you've extended to the constituents from my district.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Jack. So, good afternoon. Like John said, my name is Sherry Halliday. I think what he didn't mention was, besides being a former mayor and now county commissioner, I'm the general manager for the Southern Wasco County Ambulance Service at Maupin, Oregon. I've been an EMT since 1980. I guess that makes 27 years. But I'm here to tell you a little bit about our agency and how we operate. And Jennifer will follow up or break in whenever she needs to talk about the training in dollars and the equipment dollars. So our ambulance service is pretty unique. We started 55 years ago as a volunteer ambulance service, and we are still a volunteer ambulance service. We receive no tax dollars from anyone. We are a private, non-profit corporation who manages to keep running strictly by what we receive for our transport costs, some small grants, and some donations. I don't know how familiar you are with Wasco County, but we run about 200 calls per year. We have two major highways, the famous Deschutes River, lots of agricultural and industrial use, much more recreational hunting and fishing. We have two small cities we cover, and five unincorporated communities. Some of you may remember the summer of 2006 was quite deadly on the Deschutes River, thinking we had five drownings, which our staff responded to. That's very difficult for volunteers, and makes that very difficult to recruit new volunteers when they know that they have to respond to those kind of circumstances. Like the people before me have said, it's very expensive to send volunteers for training, and we just cannot afford to do it. We can't expect the volunteers to pay for their own training. So we're really sort of up a tree when it comes to trying to recruit and retain new people. We are in the process of purchasing a new ambulance at this time. We have two old ambulances, way about 1990. That's our newest one. And our backup ambulance is in 1987. We have to finance our ambulances because we can not afford to buy them outright. The last one we financed for 7 years took us to pay for, and I'm thinking that's exactly what we'll be doing at this time. So $120,000 is a lot of money to come up with. Now, let me put on my Wasco County Commissioner's hat. The Southern Roswell County Ambulance from Maupin, we have a volunteer ambulance service at Dufour, which is about 25 miles away from us, and two non-transporting agencies all have contracts with Roswell County. These contracts are renewable annually and include clauses that would allow us to discontinue our provider service with a 30-day notice from either the county could fire us if they wanted to, or we could tell the county that we're not going to be able to continue our service. As a commissioner, I just absolutely cannot imagine that what that would do to Wasco County's budget. We have no resources whatsoever, so Wasco County is very appreciative of these volunteer ambulance services. We have one paid fire and ambulance service, and that's in the Dalles. They are tax-supported. But if we can't get the dollars to train our volunteers for the rural parts of the county and the services dissolve, again, I just can't tell you what Wasco County budget is suffering at this time, and a blow like that would be absolutely devastating. Our transport times are sometimes can be as close as an hour and sometimes as much as 3 hours. We cover huge territory, several hundred square miles. So, in closing, I just can't tell you the appreciation I have for the volunteers, for what they do to leave their jobs and their families, and the level of commitment they have. So I would be happy to answer any questions. If not, Jennifer Michke will follow up with the education and equipment part of our presentation.
Good afternoon. I am the training officer for our ambulance service, as well as a retired school teacher, and have been serving on the crew since 1977. Our community is very supportive of the volunteer ambulance service, and most of the employers within the area allow their employees to respond to emergency calls during the workday if needed. And our crew is entirely volunteer, and the demands are great. Of course, you've heard the money is tight. It's difficult to keep volunteers, let alone recruit new ones. We need to gather monies any way that we can, often through donations, to try to bring training to our area. If we need to go to some other area for training, we always have to leave some crew members behind, of course, to answer emergency calls. That puts the burden on them to try to get the training elsewhere that we got. And so it's better if we can get some sort of trainers to come to our area and train everybody at the same time. We have a person, Donna Wilson, who is with the mobile training unit for all of Eastern Oregon, who comes and does training for us, but she's stretched very thin, and booking is difficult at times. It would be great if we could get some more funding for other people that we could recruit to come in to us, that we could pay for their training for us. It's also, as far as payment for new volunteers, it's very difficult being a volunteer agency to try to get people to pay their own education and also all the hours it takes for them to put in. Anyway, we need access to more training funds in order to get more people to come in and volunteer for us. We also need equipment for our ambulances. Equipment is necessary, required by the state, and expensive. We've purchased defibrillators, a new stretcher, oximeter to measure oxygen in the blood, and other expensive equipment through grant monies, and we'll continue to need to do that. The ambulances throughout the state are expected to have the equipment, but it's an additional burden on rural ambulances to have to purchase these materials, because we have fewer runs, and of course that means fewer dollars. I urge you to support the bill, and if you have any questions for me or comments, I appreciate it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Ramona Sanderson.
Do you ever have distance learning? I keep thinking I thought I was in Wasco County. Is the Wasco next to the Hood River?
Yes.
So I was there in Wasco County, and they were showing me that there are some unit, and I think it was a mobile unit, but were telling me about doing a lot of distance learning because that's the only way that you could get trained.
Correct. We have the mobile training unit with Donna Wilson who comes, but we tried doing some satellite communications and talking on the telephone and getting it through a video recorder. Communication was really sketchy, and it was through the high school, and their wiring was not the best, and we tried it once. It didn't work very well.
Well, that's an area I know that Senator Nelson and I have always, telecommunications is our you know, sort of our pet, so to speak, and always looking at ways to have broadband communication, better broadband, so that you can get good training in the rural areas to help you out.
That's a great thing that's going to happen in the future. It's going to be great for us to be able to access that. Some of our firefighters are actually doing some of that over the internet, but at this point there hasn't been a lot of ambulance training.
I'm sorry that we didn't have this meeting at 1 o'clock instead of 3 o'clock, because I know that some of you have traveled a long way to get here. Many of you are well over 100 miles. I just want to assure you that your testimony is extremely important. We feel that this is the beginning. The amount of money that we're asking for is not enough to do the job that needs to be done, but we're trying to really get going now. We've been at this now for a couple of years. There was a small amount of money given. The governor does have some money in his budget for rural Oregon. We want to get more money. We are looking at cigarette tax. We're also I'm having conversations with the governor's office about economic development money, which is lottery money, and that is a growing pot. Because this is economic development, because if you expect to have businesses coming to your area and people moving their families there, it is absolutely essential that we do have adequate health care.
Absolutely.
And so this is economic development, and on top of that, we're trying to establish this this funding mechanism, this foundation, these grants, and to draw in some foundation support, because I think once the state puts money into that other entities will come in, some foundations will come in, and this is community building. So that's what we're about, community building in rural Oregon. And I think healthcare and schools are the basics, the basic components of that. So thank you so much for taking the time to come over here. Really
thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
And Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yes, I noticed that there are a number of people from rural Oregon in the audience, and I just want to say Senator Morissette is from the Valley, lives in Springfield, and has such a heart for rural Oregon, and I think we just don't lift up that kind of thinking enough. We think in terms of people in the Valley just not caring about those of us who are in rural Oregon, and that's not the case, and you're looking at a living example of it today.
Okay. We're going to go from Christmas Valley to, let's see, to Seaside. How's that? So, Bill Sexton, would you come up, please? Is Bill here?
It's Bill Wilbur.
Bill Wilbur. And we have Jim Carlson from the Asher Clinic and Bruce Carlson. Chris, would you folks come up, please? I'm sorry, Bill, you're from Seaside?
I'm from Burns.
Burns! Okay.
Close.
Well, Bill Sexton, then, who is on the list, apparently is not here. Okay. So Burns and Christmas Valley, that's pretty close. That is pretty close. That's very close.
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Bill Wilbur. I'm a retired hospital administrator, healthcare consultant, and a cattle rancher in Harney County. Sitting here listening to this testimony brought back some memories from 1969, which I'm going to share with you at the end of this, because I think it's illustrative of the need for transportation, particularly non-emergency medical services. On behalf of the 57 acute care community hospitals, healthcare systems, and the patients we serve, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I especially appreciate your continuing interest in healthcare challenges facing Oregon rural communities. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 37, which will dedicate a percentage of current tobacco tax revenues to rural safety net programs and services. 36 of Oregon's hospitals are designated as rural hospitals. They are the cornerstone of a viable rural health care safety net. They maintain emergency rooms that are available 24 hours a day. The challenges that urban hospitals face are only amplified many times in a rural setting. Maintaining a viable community hospital is essential for recruiting, retaining rural physicians and other medical specialists, as well as the economy of the entire community, which you mentioned. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you for coming. I just wanted you to know that my committee is called Health Policy and Public Affairs. We'll be in Burns. We're taking our entire committee to Burns on March 2nd. And we're going to ask public testimony. So if you want to put any few words either on this bill or whatever other concerns that you might have, we'd love to see you there. It'll be at the high school.
I heard that this afternoon on the steps of the Capitol. I hadn't been aware of that. But rest assured, I will be there.
Awesome. All right.
We're asking, well, the funds from the viability program will also go to the rural health office to assist rural communities in maintaining vital health care community services. And part of that is to deal with the Hilberton hospitals that were built in the 50s and 60s. And I can tell you from personal experience of 30 plus years in this business of working in Hilberton hospitals as a CEO and as a consultant, that dealing with the issues of old buildings and old equipment is overwhelming. And a part of the reason that some hospitals close is because they can't deal with the regulation and the rules. And it goes back to programs that were well-intended, but there was no financing to continue them. Grants would be available to contract for financial feasibility studies for replacement and modernization of aging facilities and equipment, preservation and access to local health services through short-term financial support, and expanded access to health care for financially and physically vulnerable rural populations. What occurred to me when I was listening to this testimony was when I went to John Day in 1969 as the CEO of the hospital, we did not have an ambulance, and we had no trained EMTs. And I hate to confess this, but it's a fact. And I would just want never to see something even come close to this again. The call car for people in accidents and or in mill accidents and or logging accidents was the Driscoll Mortuary call car. And it had Driscoll Mortuary run on the side of the ambulance. And I was appalled. I could not believe it. I couldn't believe that somebody would be injured, lying in the ditch, hurt physically, and to have that mental trauma of, am I going to die? Am I dead and this is a dream? That actually went on. So we scurried around and got a grant and got an ambulance. And we trained about 15 people as EMTs, and I was one of those. And we were the first, or somewhere among the first to be trained in 1970 as EMTs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Senator Cruz and I and others, Ed Patterson for one, visited Burns Hospital, I believe in 01. We were on a 4-day trip, and we covered 14 sites, and we were there on the day that your internist, I believe, was sending a diagnostic picture to St. Charles. So you do have that ability to send diagnostic. And then we visited St. Charles, which is a little bit more upscale than Burns.
A little bit.
And we then witnessed the other end of that, where they were receiving diagnostic images from other places. So, but you're right, and we did go to, we were in John Day, and we saw the hospital there, and went to Sumter, and they have a bake sale to buy, you know, fund their ambulance, and so we had quite a trip, and that made a lasting impression.
I will tell you, Senator, when you come to Burns, the replacement hospital, which is being built almost over the top of the existing hospital so it can continue to function, will open in about 6 months. So great strides there as far as hospitals go. Retaining physicians, retaining nurses and other health care people is still very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
My name is Jim Carlson. I run the Asher Clinic in Fossil, Oregon, and I have for the last 3 years. For those who might not be familiar with Wheeler County, we have three little towns. One, Fossil, 450 people. If you sort of plop that down where Portland is, well, down where Salem would be, about 45 miles south, we have the little town of Mitchell, 170 people. And out where Estacada is, we have the little town of Spray, about 120. We don't have any hospitals. We don't have any doctors. We don't have any dentists. And thank goodness we don't have any stoplights. Some of us like it like that. We have two physician assistants out of a single clinic serving that entire county. That is how we serve it. We also serve it with three volunteer EMS groups, and everything you've heard about the EMS groups is basically applies to us. It's very hard to get volunteers, and we've had people going on at 20, 30 years, just like some of the people you've heard. One lady pushing her 80s says, "Hun, I just can't get over those vacants anymore and back down and up, so I just have to go back to driving." So periodically, we do need to renew our pool, and this money is important. Now, I've put some budget numbers to you. As the administrator, I have to make the bottom line balance out. Out of every dollar we spend, this is this year's budget after we've cut $3,000 a month out of it to break even, after I've borrowed $20,000 to make my January payroll, about 47 cents on the dollar comes from patient fees. Officerial health has been there for years and years for us. We were one of the lucky ones when they had money that our Fossil ambulance came from them. They've also come out periodically over the years and held our hand to sympathize and said, "You guys need at least $180,000 a year subsidy." We finally made the transition in January 05 from a rural health center to a federally qualified health center, which brings us this 31 cents on the dollar, which now keeps us open. What's interesting about that is it comes with a lot of ropes and knots, one of which is we can't be any part of the emergency system. We can't send our PAs out to a road wreck because the feds won't allow it as primary care, not emergency care. So we are dependent out there on the continued goodwill.
Diagnostic images from other places. So, but you're right, and we did go to, we were in John Day, and we saw the hospital there, and went to Sumter, and they have a bake sale to buy, you know, fund their ambulance, and so we had quite a trip, and that made a lasting impression.
I will tell you, Senator, when you come to Burns, the replacement hospital, which is being built almost over the top of the existing hospital so it can continue to function, will open in about 6 months. So great strides there as far as hospitals go. Retaining physicians, retaining nurses and other health care people is still very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
My name is Jim Carlson. I run the Asher Clinic in Fossil, Oregon, and I have for the last 3 years. For those who might not be familiar with Wheeler County, we have three little towns. One, Fossil, 450 people. If you sort of plop that down where Portland is, well, down where Salem would be, about 45 miles south, we have the little town of Mitchell, 170 people. And out where Estacada is, we have the little town of Spray, about 120. We don't have any hospitals. We don't have any doctors. We don't have any dentists. And thank goodness we don't have any stoplights. Some of us like it like that. We have two physician assistants out of a single clinic serving that entire county. That is how we serve it. We also serve it with three volunteer EMS groups. And everything you've heard about the EMS groups is basically applies to us. It's very hard to get volunteers, and we've had people going on at 20, 30 years, just like some of the people you've heard. One lady pushing her 80s says, "Hunt, I just can't get over those vacants anymore and back down and up, so I just have to go back to driving." So periodically, we do need to renew our pool, and this money is important. Now, I've put some budget numbers to you. As the administrator, I have to make the bottom line balance out. Out of every dollar we spend, this is this year's budget after we've cut $3,000 a month out of it to break even, after I've borrowed $20,000 to make my January payroll, about 47 cents on the dollar comes from patient fees. Officer Rural Health has been there for years and years for us. We were one of the lucky ones when they had money that our Fossil ambulance came from them. They've also come out periodically over the years and held our hand to sympathize and said, "You guys need at least $180,000 a year subsidy." We finally made the transition in January 05 from a rural health center to a federally qualified health center, which brings us this 31 cents on the dollar, which now keeps us open. What's interesting about that is it comes with a lot of ropes and do nots, one of which is we can't be any part of the emergency system. We can't send our PAs out to a road wreck because the feds won't allow it as primary care, not emergency care. So we are dependent out there on the continued goodwill of the state of Oregon to help support our EMS services. And that includes people from Portland that drive out to Camp Hancock and get in trouble. We are the only ones there. We are the only trauma room in the county. But the EMS folks have to get them to us. We can't go out to them. Now, the clinic itself, you take 47 cents and 31 cents. We're still short. We have a local tax district that helped keep the door open. And we were recently the first school-based health center in Frontier, Oregon. All the school-based health centers have been in schools of 600 or more by reg. And somebody finally figured out that left out most of that big wide open space out there. So they waived that rule for us. And we have in Mitchell School with 70 kids now the first school-based health center. And that allowed us to get our second PA. So now we can cover Spray and Mitchell 2 days a week, Fossil 4.5 days a week with 24/7 emergency response in Fossil. So I guess what I'm here to say is thank you for your support. It's obvious, I think I'm preaching to the choir here of Senate Bill 37. Even though we are not a rural health center and won't benefit from that portion of the bill, the Office of Rural Health was instrumental in getting us to where we are now, and certainly our EMS services are still very dependent on help, because if I double my fees, I'm not going to double my income. I'm going to drive away a few paying patients and dig that place a hole.
Do you have a nursing home in Fossil?
We have a retirement center across the street, Haven House, that the Collins Foundation helped fund.
Oh, okay.
And we sort of invented integrated services long before the bureaucracy decided they need to put the pieces back together. So we make our nurse available to them for $200 a month because they need a nurse and they can't afford it. And then they send us their Medicare patients and we keep it open. Butler County Public Health also shares a location with us, mm-hmm. as does Asher Home Health Services. So we're really a symbiotic whole out there to make it work. We share overhead. I do the payroll for three out of those four organizations.
So how many patients and your clients in your nursing home?
Well, we've got, our judge Gene Birch likes to say that Wheeler County has less coyotes per square mile than Multnomah County does, less people per square mile than Multnomah County has coyotes. And it's true, we have 1,500 people and 1,700 square miles. We served last year about 650 of those people. And so that's pretty good penetration. Of course, there's no other choices unless you go to Bend or John Day.
Well, how many people do you have in your nursing home?
Oh, in the nursing home. In Haven House, I'm thinking it's in the neighborhood of 20 to 25.
Now, these are community people.
A lot of the ranchers, when they lose their spouse, will come there. And we also get people who just want a sensible place to live where you can walk in the streets and walk to the nearest store, which is 4 blocks away, and get help if you need it. And so we have people from outside coming in, too.
Well, and again, a nursing home, I think, you know, that's the roots of a community, because a lot of the people who are getting elderly and have to go to a completely different community to retire, you know, that's a terrible loss.
Yeah, we can't have that. I mean, they grow up, that's their home,
right.
And Asher Home Health keeps them stabilized there, gets them out of the nursing, keeps them going to a nursing home, gets them out of the hospital faster. Now, the Haven House is not a nursing home proper, although it's technically a retirement center. All out there, you sort of blur the lines and do what you have to do to keep folks at home.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Bruce Carlson. I'm a physician. I'm a chairman of the Oregon Rural Health Coordinating Council. Since I'm also the owner of a rural health clinic, I've been asked to testify about the importance of Senate Bill 37 to isolated rural health clinics.
Now, you're from Christmas Valley.
That's where one of my clinics is. It's in Christmas Valley.
Okay.
I actually live in Umatilla, Oregon. And I actually grew up in Senator Vergeer's area in Coos Bay.
Oh.
And when I was growing up, our local ambulance service was run by Mills Funeral Home. And he was also the coroner, so there's some real question about conflicts of interest.
I grew up in a town like that.
Yeah. Anyway, the rural health clinics that I'm referring to are medical clinics in rural areas that are certified under the Federal Rural Health Clinic Act passed in 1979. So just because you're a clinic in a rural area does not make you a rural health clinic unless you're certified.
Okay.
Most of these clinics are in isolated rural areas such as Jordan Valley, Dexter, and Chiloquin. In these cases, the clinic is a sole community provider of medical care. Other clinics are located in Alsea, Reedsport, Jordan Valley, Gold Beach, Arlington, Pacific City, Port Orford, Reedsport, Elgin, Condon, Huron, Oak Ridge, Lapine, Nissa, Blue River, Morrow, Gold Beach, Christmas Valley, Brookings, Scappoose, Shady Cove, Union, Heppner, Wheeler, Rogue River, Powers, Yahats, and Vernonia. And I believe these are all sole provider clinics in the community. And for some of you, you've been given the book from the Office of Rural Health that shows the clinics in Oregon with the pictures of the different clinics on the cover. Fortunately, I don't have that with me today, but you can see that they look... in all storefronts, old houses, there's quite a motley combination of physical facilities. Many of these clinics are located in communities of less than 1,000 population. Some of the communities are unincorporated. The clinics in these small areas are also very small, many with an annual budgets of less than $300,000 per year. Some have limited property tax support, others do not. Because of their limited financial resources, they are restricted in the amount of charity care they can provide and still remain viable. Some of these clinics qualify as isolated rural health facilities in that they are the only health care resource in their community, and this is what Senate Bill 37 will address. The economies of many of these communities have been resource-based. With the decline in resource-based industries such as logging and farming, there's been a decline in the economies in these areas. As a consequence, there's been an increase in unemployment and poverty, with the resultant effect of individuals being unable to afford necessities of life, including medical care. I'll give you a specific example of one area which I'm knowledgeable. There are other areas in the state in similar predicament. The area I'm referring to is Christmas Valley, which is located on a high plateau 93 miles southeast of Bend, Oregon. The closest hospital is in Bend. The closest pharmacy is 63 miles away in Lapine, Oregon. The town is not incorporated, and in 2004, the population estimate was 1,748 people. This area also has a high level of poverty, about double the state average. There, with reductions in Oregon Health Plan, we are witnessing increasing numbers of medically needy individuals now without any safety net available for needed care. Being a small clinic, there are limited resources for uncompensated care. Our budget last year was $270,000, of which $78,000 was taxpayer funded from a property tax. In terms of safety net, the closest free or reduced fee clinic is in Bend, 93 miles away. Most of these individuals have no or unreliable transportation, and there's no public transportation available. There is a branch office of the County Health Department, but they do not provide any primary care. Grants supplied to some of these isolated rural health facilities will help strengthen the rural safety net. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present in support of Senate Bill 37.
Thank you. Questions? Comments? Thank you very much. Senator Timms, would you come up, please, and bring Ed Patterson with you? Come on. Come on, Senator Timms.
Where do you want me?
Oh, right there in the middle. Or, well, let's see. Is Ed going to sit on? I guess, yeah, why don't you sit in the middle?
And why am I, you asking me up here?
Why not?
Just don't embarrass me.
The problems are the same as they were 30 years ago.
I'm surprised Edna lets you out.
Well, I think that it's important to have one of the icons from rural Oregon, from Burns, present, and I think we want to acknowledge you and thank you for being here.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank all of you for serving. I did it for 18 years, and I tell you, it's not easy. And I go out in the hall, and a third of the people are still here, especially the lobbyists.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, you're a good one, Ed. You don't charge any money.
Now, you heard Senator Monta Sanderson say that her committee is going to be in Burns next week.
No,
March 2nd.
Yeah. Good. So you will be there, right?
Be there.
March 2nd, I may be in. Palm Springs.
No, Palm Springs. Well, cancel your flight. Okay, Ed Patterson.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ed Patterson. I represent the Oregon Association, the Oregon Rural Health Association. I'm going to not beguile you with my written testimony today because I did that last Friday.
Okay.
But I want to talk about the funding issue as you directed me to. And actually, I asked Senator Timms to come up to run that thing because I don't know how to do it.
Oh.
So if he would just...
Didn't have those when I was there.
And also, he told me quietly when you were talking about Crispin Valley that when he was state senator over there, Crispin Valley was the only ones who voted for his opposition. And I told him it's because they're very smart people at Crispin Valley.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, these will change the
light. Then you can get the lights when you go back. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. This is the climax. This is it right now. This is what everyone's been waiting for, right?
Right.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, this bill was put together the same as the bill was in the last legislative session. We also used the same funding element, which is tobacco revenue, for the bill, which is what we did last session.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, those are the essentials of the bill. What we're asking for, as you can see, this is a one-year amount. It's fiscal year 07-08. Total tobacco revenue, that includes all revenue, which is also in the packet that was handed out.
Mm-hmm.
All revenue for that one year is projected to be $355.1 million from tobacco sources, including the master settlement agreement. And you can see the background there, each of those elements, where the money is distributed to, and what percentage of the total funds there are. The funding for the bill comes from 3.5% of the cigarette tax revenue total. And the 3.5% annually is $8.2 million. So the bill requires an $8.2 million appropriation to fund the activities that we were talking about. The breakdown for the services is...
Mr. Chair, Just to back up, just for the record. Okay.
One more time.
Okay, just to back up for the record, because you can see there's distinct allocations out of that, and the 2.3 comes out of the general fund allocation.
That's correct.
Not out of the distinct other funding streams.
That's exactly right. The chart that I passed out will show that there would be $59 million plus in the general fund appropriation had that rural health amount not been backed out.
Right.
As it turns out, the balance of $51-plus million is actually about the same as it was 2 years ago. In fact, it's a little bit more.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Ed, on this tobacco reduction, I never do see the results. I see how much money is spent on trying to get people to stop smoking, but I never see the results of how many people actually stop smoking for the money that is spent on that program. And that's a pretty good chunk of change.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, I have no expertise on how well that money is spent or what success they have. I suspect that there are those probably in the back of the room that could present their viewpoints on it.
Hadn't worked on me.
Good. You need the money.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Any other questions on that? And this is the breakdown that you've been talking about, the three areas of the bill. Emergency medical services would receive $1.2 million. The clinics for rural health clinics, $2.4 million, and the rural health liability grants would be $4.6 million, and again, that's 1 year. It would be $8.2 million, or about $16.5 million for the biennium. The point I would like to stress is that bottom number there, where it says total rural health. You can see of all the total funds, even though the money came from 3.5% of the cigarette tax, of all the revenues that state receives from tobacco, only 2.3% is allocated to rural health. That's a very small percentage, and I think you can tell by the witnesses you had today that it really doesn't take all that much money by comparison to solve some major problems in the rural areas, only 2.3%. So while there will be those, I'm sure, who will oppose funding this way, I think it's a good way to fund it. Most of the tobacco funds just come in from settlement monies and spent on non-anti-smoking programs. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with you in terms of the tobacco settlement or the tobacco money, and when this bill goes to Ways and Means, as it did last year, that's when our battle begins, and we need to fight very hard at the Ways and Means level, and I am on the Ways and Means Subcommittee this time, and we need to work hard, and we need to, you know, remind people of why we're doing it. You know, the testimony that we've heard today needs to live on. We need to talk about that. We need to make sure that all members of the legislature, whether or not they're from rural Oregon, get the message of what this money is for and how it benefits everyone in the state who travels the roads in rural Oregon, and it benefits the economic health of the state. The viability of Oregon's economy depends on this very thing. And so I'm also talking with the governor for other additional funding that, you know, to make sure that we get at least the 8.2. And so, you know, I think we've worked hard on this over the last couple of years, and we will continue to, you know, to do that. Cast a broad net and make sure that we have lots of support from around the state. That's what it takes.
Mr. Chair, the predicament we're in now is all Gene Kim's fault. So, and I say that because when Senate Bill 911 was passed and funded, he was the Senate co-chair of Ways and Means, and if he'd have kept that position, we'd have still had the money coming through, but he bailed on us. So, and also I'd like to point out we are going to Burns later on, and Burns is one of the few cities in the state of Oregon that does have its own song. And I'm not going to ask Jane to sing it today, but no. In all seriousness, Gene Timms was a huge advocate for rural Oregon and did a good job for a lot of years. And and we've kind of picked up the mantle, and I'll do whatever I can to help when it comes to full ways and means to get those folks to understand the need here.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm the executive director for the Oregon Rural Health Association, and we have about 750 individual members that pay dues. Not very much, but they pay a little dues. Mm-hmm. We have about 40 organizations that are organizational members that make a contribution. And I can assure you that we will do everything we can to make sure they're aware of the situation and the politics of what needs to be done, and provide as much of that muscle for your use. Do what we can to get the legislature to support this.
Thank you, and I think that's, as you know, that's what it's going to take, because somehow we just, you know, we've fallen short the last couple of years, right, and we have to do it right this time. So,
yep.
Good. Thank you.
Well, we thank you for your time.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. So we'll close the public hearing, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 37.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 37 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 37 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I think we had some great testimony today. One of the things that always strikes me when I go to some of the parts of the of Oregon that the people came from today is this wide expanse of no people at all, and I think about having to drive those distances, then pay for your training, mm-hmm, so that you can go home and volunteer. I think that is really a call to service for your community when you can do that, and I think that hopefully the argument can be made in ways and means to help to continue to contribute money into these programs that are so vital for rural Oregon.
Okay. Other comments? Okay. Let's call the roll, please.
Senator George?
Excused.
Senator Monson?
Aye.
Senator Brugger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. The bill, Senate Bill 37, having received the constitutional majority, will go to the Ways and Means Committee.
Isn't that terrible?
That's terrible. Okay. Well, we'll work on that.
Yes.
We've done what we can so far, and we'll just keep working on it. So, okay. Other business before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.